Right, welcome back. Our second speaker this afternoon is V. Wiener, who is a professor in the philosophy department at the University of Cincinnati. He has recently published a book on Newton and empiricism, which just came out this year with Oxford University Press. You'll be speaking to us today on the topic of, oh, you changed your title.
I did.
Good thing I looked. Newton and Galileo. Please join me in welcoming Professor Wiener.
Thank you. Thank you, Lisa, for inviting me, and it's an honor to be in a panel with such distinguished people. And I should explain the change in title first. So, about 2 years ago, I was actually asked to write a paper for one of those Oxford handbooks on Newton and Galileo. And I said, no, it's a red herring. There's nothing there. Just move on. If you want something on Newton and Huygens, that's not an essay, that's a book or several books, but just don't worry about Newton and Galileo. So, when you asked me to think of a talk, I thought, well, Galilean tradition, that's going to be more interesting in there for my original title. But lo and behold, once I started looking at the details, there's a bit more there than a red herring. And that's what I'll talk about today. But there is some truth to the downplaying of the connection between Newton and Galileo. There's a myth in sort of elementary history of science that this is, of course, the Newtonian picture by a local hero, I. Bernard Cohen, who's clearly not responsible for this image. But there's Newton, who synthesizes Kepler and Galileo, so obviously he had to know lots about Kepler and Galileo to achieve what he had to achieve. And that part is false. In fact, I have elsewhere in the slides other covers of this, so it's clearly not I. Bernard Cohen's fault. The covers are absolutely crazy. Sometimes it seems like Kepler is the one who's most important, and Galileo and Newton are in the background. It's very strange. But Newton actually didn't know that much about Galileo. He didn't read much of Galileo at all. Let me just read this a little bit. It's likely that Newton read the Sidereus Nuncius in Cambridge in the early 1660s, but his library contained only the 1682 copy, that one, which was printed alongside Gassendi's Institutio Astronomicae and Kepler's Dioptrics. But he never cited or otherwise referred to the work. Newton read the dialogues on two chief world systems during two different periods, one in college between 1661 and 65, and one after the publication of the Principia in the mid-1690s. His college notes from the earlier period concerned free fall, and quote almost directly from the third day of the dialogue in the 1661 English Salisbury edition, which is also published alongside other writings of Kepler and a bunch of people on biblical interpretation. The Salisbury translation of the Discourse, the two new sciences, appeared in 1665. This is very much on a delay. I don't know why. There we go. 1665. But it is unlikely that Newton never saw it. Most copies were destroyed in the 1666 fire, and the remaining 8 copies were obviously rather rare. Prior to the publication of the Principia in 1684, Newton could have had access to untranslated editions of the Discourse, but he didn't read Italian, so he would have had to leaf through to the end to see that there's a part in Latin. And the only edition he owned of the Discourse was published in 1699, and it is unmarked. There's no record of him reading any other earlier edition. The scholarly consensus is that Newton learned about the two new sciences mostly from secondary sources. Of the books in his library, Galileo was extensively discussed in Walter Chalton's Physiologia, Kenelm Digby's two treatises, Robert Anderson's The Genuine Use and Effects of the Gun, and several of Gassendi's work. Galilean premises and results were also incorporated into the works of Huygens, Wren, Wallace, Torricelli, works with which Newton was very familiar. And it was this sort of reasoning that led me to think a few years ago that, in fact, there's nothing to mine here. But in order to start preparing for this talk, I went through and I tried to find all the instances in which Newton mentions Galileo. Oh, and is there a handout? Where's Elizabeth? There's a handout that's somewhere. And it is a list of Newton's mentions of Galileo, as well as the relevant Galileo editions, which is nearly comprehensive, I think. Right? I say nearly because I know of one reference for sure. Bernard Cohn says that there's one reference to Galileo in the third edition of the Principia that exists only in the third edition, and I just can't find it. I'm sure I'm just not looking somewhere closely enough. But I think everything else is pretty much comprehensive. And of course, I don't have my copy, so excuse me. If you ask me questions about the notes on my copy, I'll tell you that I can't answer them. So you can see there are some of the additions I mentioned. And what I think, when you look at these references, and what I'll spend today doing is basically going through this list in one fashion or another, is that there's four main periods / categories of use that we could find in this. All right. Now, just to show you how the list is used, I've used these. These were just my notes that I made when I was writing them down, but they're still in there. Next to each mention of Galileo, there's an indication of in the context of what, right? So is Newton talking about an astronomical observations related to Galileo, talking about the parabolic path of projectiles where you turn to, or several of these other things, okay? Now, I'm going to focus on 2 and 4, on periods 2 and 4 in the talk itself. But let me just mention a few things about box 1 and box 3. Box 3 is in the 1690s. That's a typo there. It just says 1692, not 1662. And the discussion there is the one Dan was alluding to in his talk. That is, the context is an exchange with Bentley. Bentley is preparing his first Boyle lecture, or the first of the Boyle lecture. It's actually the eighth lecture that he's preparing, on fighting atheism. And what they're trying to figure out is the design argument regarding the structure of the cosmos, the solar system, right? And that's why they entertain the Galilean hypothesis, which Galileo attributes to Plato, that the planets all fell from one spot and then diverted in their tracks. I think, in fact, what they're trying to figure out is the opposite of the design argument, so to speak. This comes up as a possible naturalistic explanation that needs to be dispelled, and in fact, Newton dispels it and does the math and shows, no, in fact, they could not have fallen from the same place, and tells Bentley this. Now, Newton is the one that brings up the hypothesis. Bentley then points out to him that Galileo had said it, and then Newton surely looks back at the dialogue, if he hadn't known about it already, and quotes from it. And then shortly thereafter, if you see on the flip side of the page in number 3, he incorporates this Galilean hypothesis in the so-called classical scholia that were supposed to be added to book 3 of the Principia in a possible revision that never really saw light. Okay. Number 1 is the period before the Principia, box number 1. It's mostly his college years in the 60s. Now, what's striking to me about that period is that there's the main focus is on establishing the absolute value of free fall. It is measuring free fall. Now, sorry, didn't mean to do that. The absolute value of free fall, the time squared law for descent, and the parabolic path of projectiles are obviously highly interrelated, right? However, in each context, there's a focus of discussion, and that's what I'm focusing on. That is, what actually is he trying to figure out? Is he trying to measure it? Is he talking about the time squared, or extending the time squared log the parabolic path. So in the 1616s, it seems that measurement of the rate of fall is what is on his mind. All right, but that changes once we get to the Principia period. And so let me just foreshadow some of the things that I'm going to say before leading us a little bit more carefully through box number two. The first is that I think there is some reason to think, despite where I started, that Newton did read the discourse before the second edition of the Principia. Not very carefully, but I think we could make the case that he did read it. Second conclusion is that Newton's mentions of Galileo in the first edition are remarkably uniform, and that's what I'll try to convince you, and thus cry for an explanation. That is, why is he fixing on one particular aspect of Galileo? It'll be the parabolic path of projectiles when finding of Galileo over all others. And the answer will be that Newton's mentions of Galileo are intended to direct readers to one of the works' main innovations. And then I'll offer some speculations about Galileo, not others, are recruited for this purpose. All right, so let's start. In 1684, you know the story. Holly, after presented with a 40-shilling book, comes to Newton and asks him for a question, that is, what is the shape of the orbit a projectile would take if attracted to the center with a r-squared law? Newton says, hey, I solved that a bunch of time ago. It's an ellipse. Halley says, well, okay, where's the proof? Newton says, it's somewhere in my papers. I'll look for it. What comes out of that looking, quote-unquote looking, is the first version of what was going to be called the Principia, which is de motu corporum in gyrum, on the motion of bodies in circuits or tracts or something like that. Horses run in these things, gyrum. And in this work, he begins with some hypothesis. Let me just read them. Hypothesis 2, every body, by its innate force alone, proceeds uniformly into infinity, following a straight line, unless it be impeded by something from without. Hypothesis 3, a body is carried in a given time by a combination of forces to the place where it is born by the separate forces acting successively in equal times. And hypothesis 4, the space in which a body urged by any centripetal force describes at the very beginning of its motion is in the double ratio of the time. All right, and that's what I want to focus on here, the double ratio of the time. Now, this is in square brackets because, in fact, it doesn't appear in the very first version of this manuscript. This is the manuscript itself. You could see there is hypothesis 1, hypothesis 2. Hypothesis 4 is only indicated over here. That is, it was added at a later time when Newton realizes, wait a second, there's a substantial assumption here that I'm missing. I've got to add it. Now, as an aside about the hazards of digital scholarship, because this led to a very confused an hour or two on my part, the Cambridge digitization of this page looks like this. They folded over the page precisely where that extra bit is. Okay, no more pointer. Precisely where that extra bit is. So I went looking for it, and I couldn't find it. Finally, it occurred to me that, wait a minute, could I find a different picture of this page? And in fact, it was there. So be careful with the digitalization project. All right. We could see... Oh, it's still working. It's just the pointer somehow is weird. That's fine. We could see where Newton realizes that he needs this assumption, which is right over here. See, hypothesis 4 is scratched out. I'll tell you why in a second. It's in theorem 3, in which Newton presents really one of the main innovations, if not the main innovations, that drives the Principia, which is a measure of the force at a given point in the trajectory, given some elements of the trajectory itself. That is, that you could read off the quantity of the force from the trajectory. Now, in order to make this work, and we don't need to go over it, what's important is that as a body moves in this trajectory and is deviated
by a central force. Its deviation in the very beginning of the fall is as the time squared. Okay? And that's when he realizes, okay, so time squared is essential for this. This is going to be hypothesis four. And that's when it's added to the that first version.
Now, in the second version of this manuscript, that's now developed into lemma 2. That's why it was scratched out in that previous version and lemma 2 written underneath it. Same exact phraseology. And here is where Newton writes for the first time, as Galileo explains, regarding this time squared law. Now, what in fact Galileo explains here is not the full proof of the time square law, which Newton does prove, but certainly not in any way that Galileo did. But rather, as Galileo explained, refers to the fact that times could be represented by line segments, and distances of fall could be represented by the triangles that those line segments give rise to, by the area of those triangles. Okay, but the context is clearly intended to, well, the context is the time squared law. Okay. In the next version, we get something much closer to the laws as we recognize them. And these, by the way, are very quick. I don't know, I didn't call attention to the times here, but they're between the fall of 1684 and the spring now of 1685. They're very quick. Law 1 has a much more familiar shape. First of all, it's called a law. Then, by reason of its innate force, every body preserves in its state of rest or of moving uniformly in a straight line, unless it is so far as it is obliged to change a state by forces impressed on it. This force stuff was not in earlier versions. The change of motion, law 2, is proportional to the force impressed and takes place along the straight line in which the force is impressed. By means of these two laws, now widely acknowledged, Galileo discovered that projectiles, under uniform gravity acting along parallel lines, describe parabolas. So the focus now, this is the first time Galileo's relation to the parabola is mentioned here, the focus shifts to the parabola. Now, sadly, this version, this is just a fragment that we have, cuts off at lemma 2, that is that lemma that proves the time squared law, and it cuts off 10 words before Galileo was mentioned in the previous draft. So perhaps he was mentioned there as well. I don't know. No one is to know. But parabolas are introduced. One more draft. This is now the version of the Principia, the first Lucasian lectures that really starts to resemble the work we have now. Here in the Scholium to the Laws, Newton writes, by means of the first two laws, which for our purposes are very much like the ones we've seen, and the first two corollaries, Galileo found the descent of heavy bodies is in the square ratio of the time, right, so time squared again, and that the motion of projectiles occurs in a parabola, except insofar as these motions are somewhat retarded by the resistance of the air. Now we have the two things joined together. But in fact, this is basically the last remaining independent mention of the time squared law in relation to Galileo. All the other mentions are going to be parabolic. They're going to be centered towards the parabola. There are going to be mentions of the parabola. In the Scholium to Proposition 9, he writes, Proposition 9, by the way, is given a particular trajectory, find the force law. Should the ellipse with its center going off to infinity turn into a parabola, the body will move in this parabola, and the force now tending to an infinitely distant center will prove to be constant. This is Galileo's theorem, right? So in constant gravity, the motion will be as Galileo said it would be. And the last two things that we've seen translate pretty much directly into the work itself. This is the first edition in the Scholium to the Laws. I'm not going to read this over. It says exactly the same thing we just said. Galileo found the descent of heavy bodies in the square ratio of the time, and that the motion of projectiles occurs in a parabola. And what Newton is thinking of here, right, if it's not clear, right, why is why is this evidence for the laws? Why is this connected with the laws for Newton? Well, it's something like this. When a body is projected along a straight line, look at that image, its motion arising from the projection is compounded in the way that we've been talking about, from the motion arising from gravity and from the projection. Right? And you can see how this goes. We don't need to go over it. But this is what Newton has in mind. This particular thing, this particular quote is not added until the third edition of the Principia, but this is certainly what he has in mind. Now, the reason it's important that I want to bring it up now, is because the compounding here is what does all the work. Right? So you have the time square law for the fall. Without the proper way of compounding that motion, and without the right choice of motions to compound, that is meaningless. Right? You have to know which two motions to compound in order to get a parabola. All right, and that's a fact we'll return to later. Compounding does all the work. Because you have the right notion of compounding, that is, because you know which two motions to compound, you could from there reason to the appropriateness of the laws of motion. Right? So the laws of motion by itself, without knowing what to compound, don't at all lend clear as credence to the parabola. Right? There's no reason Galileo would have had those laws. And as we know, he clearly didn't have those laws, right? From Dan's talk and what you know already. There's no way he did. The second mention, again, this is in the same proposition that we looked up before, but now it becomes proposition 10. It's the end of section 2. Should the ellipse with its center going off to infinity turn into a parabola, the body will move in this parabola. This is Galileo's theorem. Now, every other mention of Galileo in the Principia is connected with a parabola. There are no other mentions. So there's one mention in the final Principia, in edition 1. There is one mention of the time squared law in the scholium to the laws, and everything else concerns the parabola. So scholium to prop, besides the ones we've already seen, the scholium to prop 93, therefore with a given force the body will move in a parabola as Galileo demonstrated. This is a really interesting proposition. It seems Newton is trying to find the physical conditions that would be necessary to generate Galilean gravity. And then proposition 94 and 96. Then first, if the attraction or impulse is supposed to be uniform, the curve from what Galileo demonstrated will be a parabola. The body will be turned back, describing the arc of a parabola according to what Galileo demonstrated. And then book 2, where he considers the motion of bodies in resisting media. Here the assumption is that there is uniform gravity, but if the density of the medium is null, the projectile under those conditions would move as a parabola, as Galileo once proved. Now, what's interesting about this is all the things that are not mentioned about Galileo. Here's one thing that's not mentioned. Copernicanism. Not at all in the Principia, right? A work devoted to finding the true center of the system of the world. No mention of Galileo and Copernicanism, the thing Galileo is most famous for. No mention of pathwise independence, that is the idea that the only parameter relevant to figuring out the speed of a projectile at the end of its descent is the height of the descent, that is the inclination doesn't matter, and what follows from this, the isochronism of an appropriately chosen pendulum. Right? Now, it's not as if these items were at all mysterious or unknown. Let's have a look at Galileo, mentions of Galileo and Huygens's Horologium Oscillatorum, a work that Newton definitely read and definitely was very influential on. So at the very beginning of the work, Huygens writes, but first it will be necessary to use some new demonstrations to stabilize and expand further the doctrine of the great Galileo concerning the falling of heavy bodies, a doctrine whose most desirable fruit and highest apex is this very property of the cycloid, isochronism, which we have discovered. Galileo is mentioned several more times throughout the work. These are the contexts. Isochronism, pathwise independence and consequences, and the mean-speed theorem. That is, there's no mention of the time squared rate of fall, and there's no mention of a parabolic trajectory. I tried to go through Wallace's Mechanica, but it's just too vast. But I could tell you for a fact that there are more mentions of Galileo there than, or I should put that the other way. Mentions of Galileo there include some of these facts as well, so that there's just no way Newton would not have been quite aware that Galileo had shown some of these things. All right, so let me take an aside. Yeah?
What are Wallace's dates and what was Mechanica?
Sorry?
What are Wallace's dates?
Mechanica is in the early 60s, 61, okay. But Newton read
61, 62.
61, 62.
Mechanica, which, by the way, is also called Or the Science of Motion, which is a nice pairing that we were talking about earlier. Let me make an aside regarding my first conclusion. Look at now, and these are in your handout, mentions of Galileo in the second edition. In the second edition, Galileo's mentions are much more varied than they are in the first edition. That is, in Proposition 2, Book 2, a part added in E3, Galileo's mentioned in the context of the mean speed theorem. He's mentioned in terms of, in relation to this, where is that? This relationship in Proposition 36. Pathwise independence comes up. And then finally, free fall measurements in the square of time as well. But more than in Book 1. Now, this is by no means a conclusive evidence, but I think this may suggest that after the 1699 publication of The Discourse and the Dialogue Together in Latin, which Newton owned, we don't know when he acquired it, but he owned it, this may suggest to us that in fact he leafed through the work and saw some of the things that he mentions here. And it's not a very deep knowledge, but he had enough to say, Galileo knew these two. Otherwise, it would be somewhat odd, I think, for the references to be so uniform in the first edition and varied in the second edition. Okay, that's one of my tentative conclusions as an aside. The other issue with the uniformity of the references in the first edition is why this, right? Why point to the parabola as the important achievement of Galileo's, right? Why not anything else, especially since the state of art and mechanics and the science of motion has moved way past figuring out that the curve is a parabola at this point into way more sophisticated curves under way more sophisticated conditions. So let's return, and here I have to thank George Smith and Chris Mink, whose paper on constrained motion in that I happened to read in just the right time, I think, got me thinking in the right direction. Although this is not going to have to do anything with constrained motion. Let's return to the scolium to Proposition 10. Now I'm just going to quote a little bit more than what we saw before. And it reads, should the ellipse, right, with a center going off to infinity, turn into a parabola, the body will move in this parabola. And the force now tending to an infinitely distant center, that's a typo, will prove to be constant. This is Galileo's theorem. And if, by changing the inclination of the cutting plane to the cone, the parabolic section of the cone turns into a hyperbola, the cone will move in the perimeter of the hyperbola with the centripetal force turned into a centrifugal force. And what Newton is pointing out to here is that what he said about motion in constrained by centripetal forces generates some large classes of motion, that is, motion in parabola when the center is often infinity, but other sorts of conic sections when the work isn't. Now, here's a very good reader who got this immediately. Leibniz's notes on that very scolium read, and this explains it better than I just did, if the conatus of gravity or levity is along straight parallel lines, where the center is conceived to be infinitely or incomparably removed, and it is always constant, which is the simplest case, the line of projection will be a common parabola as Galileo showed.
The next case is with respect to a certain center at a finite distance. And the canonis with respect to the center, or paracentric, is also everywhere constant, although I do not yet know whether the line is determined.
This is Galileo, Leibniz playing weird tricks, because he's just seen Newton do this, but
doesn't know whether the line is determined. Nevertheless, first of all, we expose these generalities about centroparabolic lines, for so I like to call them.
And this should give us the clue to why the parabola. The parabola, this is the hypothesis, I'll give you more evidence in a second, is the simplest case.
Right? The simplest case of the simplest category of the types of observable motions we could get our hands on. And recovery of the simplest case is essential for Newton's general treatments of motion under force. Recovery of more sophisticated results is also necessary, but subsumption of the parabola shows that the entire class of Galilean-Hoggesian motions is a special case of motion under central forces. To put it again a different way, with help from Rupert Hall. Rupert Hall said about Galileo that his great achievement had been to dismiss all existing classifications of motion and deal with it under its simplest definitions as either uniform, rectilinear, and eternal, or uniformly accelerated, rectilinear, and eternal. We could change that and say, well, Newton's great achievement was to now categorize motion differently as motion with respect to a center and along the tangent, subsuming these categorizations of Galileo's. Now, there is an additional advantage, which is unlike sophisticated results, say, regarding isochronism, parabolic motion is one of the most familiar Galilean results. Right? With a significant body of empirical tests known even by unrefined mathematicians. And here's just a bunch of people who've worked on it, by no means exclusive. The first two, I think, are special because they're mathematically extremely unsophisticated. These are basically gunnery manuals, right? The sophistication of the rest varies, but clearly determining whether the path of the projectile is parabolic or not, and parabolic under what conditions, how much the resistance matters, etc., was a group project, to put it in that way. Take, for example, the importance of accounting for the parabolic trajectory. In 1686, that is a few months before the Principia comes out, and well after Halley knows what's coming down the pipeline, Halley publishes a discourse concerning gravity and its properties, wherein the descent of heavy bodies and the motion of projectiles is briefly but fully handled, together with a solution of a problem of great use in gunnery. Right, so this is about projectile motion. And in fact, there's a tract about projectile motion in which Halley says, Newton is working on this great stuff about centripetal forces and gravity, and then just continues talking about the parabola. Right? There's another interesting fact, which is that Hooke, the other person I had outlined, who wrote to Newton in 1679/80, it's a correspondence spans that, and whose letters to Newton actually initiate the Principia in some way, brings up precisely this problem, that is, what motion would a projectile take under certain conditions? And Hooke's particular question is, what would it take if the force towards the center, the motion toward, if the body was drawn towards the center, I should say it, in inverse square proportion to its distance? Newton's first response is this. This is supposed to be the Earth. It's rotating counterclockwise. So the what to us would be the tangential component of the projectile's motion is actually given by the Earth. It says it's going to take this path. And Hooke corrects him. He says, no, that can't be it. We don't need to go into the details of that exchange, but Newton quickly corrects itself. What's important about this exchange is that this is how it starts. Hooke says, let me know your thoughts, Newton, of that compounding of the celestial motions of a planet, of a direct motion by the tangent and an attractive motion towards the center. Right? Now, this fixes the right motions to compound. Right? Newton writes back, now, it's unclear if he's honest, but he says, look, I didn't before the receipt of your last letter so much as hear of your hypothesis of compounding the celestial motions of the planets, of a direct motion by the tangent to the curve. Now, clearly Newton knows how to compound motions, right? The question is, when you think about planetary motion, are these the right motions to compound? And what Newton is saying here, I didn't think that was the way to approach planetary motion. And in fact, in the chain of letters, he still speaks for a letter or two about the centrifugal force of the planets. That he still has, you know, the wrong paradigm in mind, right? He thinks of balancing the inertial force with a tendency outward. And only as the letters develop, does he make that switch and sees that the tendency inward and that the deviation from the tangent to the curve is what's important. All right? Hooke is special in this case because his suggestion is one of the ones which has no intrinsically curved path, like Galileo, and curved celestial motion, or curved, in fact, rectilinear, right? Eternal motion. He doesn't supply a mechanism for the tendency towards the center, and he doesn't put the problem in terms of a centrifugal force outwards balancing a centrifugal force inwards. Thank you. So he tells Newton what motions to compound, which brings it to another interesting question, or I'll say more about Hooke after raising this interesting question. Why does Newton pick Galileo as the originator of this set of theses, right? Lots of people have worked on the science of motion by this time. Why Galileo? Well, let me give you the simple answers before getting back to Hooke. Obviously, Galileo's famous, right? We can't ignore that. I'm going to try to go beyond that, but we can't ignore that. Right? Galileo is known by everyone already as the hero of the new sciences. All right. Galileo also focused attention on the problem of finding trajectories without specification of an underlying mechanism, as came out in some of Dan's talk. However, I want to, in fact, put an asterisk around this. This is probably a later emphasis of Newton's, not an emphasis that was really present in the first edition. But it's certainly there in the second edition, and in fact, in Coates' preface, do I have it here? No. In Coates' preface, I could show you later, maybe at the end, there's a long paragraph saying, ironical paragraph saying, isn't Galileo stupid? He gave us gravity without ever supplying a mechanism. Ha ha. And then he says, let me stop with these trifles, right? He's putting himself in the role of the Cartesian, saying Galileo has failed. And this is what I'm going to offer. Galileo isn't Hooke, right? Not that Galileo isn't Descartes, but Galileo isn't Hooke. Why? Well, because Hooke is the one who pointed Newton in the direction of the right sort of compounding, right? And Newton wants to make clear that this is not Hooke's contribution. Now, why he wants to do that, there might be various reasons. He had been involved in a debate with Hooke about light in the 70s, which I'll say more about in just a second. And Hooke did complain before the lines that I showed you were written, but he did complain after the first full printer's copy of the Principia landed with the Royal Society that Newton had stolen inverse square gravity from him. Now, it's really unlikely in my mind that that was the first such complaint, because the initial paper, the first De Motu, arrived at the Royal Society almost 2 years before then, right? Hooke was the secretary.
The paper was famous, it circulated. Hooke had to have seen it, and he had to have known, he had to have remembered the exchange with Newton a few years back. So maybe he was, being let it known that he was prickly about it. Maybe he didn't. I don't know. But the point is, there's no way for Newton to think while writing the laws of motion and compounding those motions in just the way that he did to arrive at Theorem 3, right, where we started, the measure of force from the deviation from the inertial trajectory. There's no way for Newton to think about that without thinking about the Hooke correspondence. Okay? Now, you might say, well, that makes sense, but what about the later propositions? Right? In your sheet, right, there's a bunch of stuff near the laws of motion in the box number 2. There's a bunch of stuff near the laws of motion. If you just look at the certificate you want. And then there's much later propositions. All right? So you might think, well, okay, so Newton might think of Hooke and want to shift focus away from Hooke when he's formulating the laws and the procedure, the fundamental procedures of the Principia, but what about later? Well, here's an interesting bit. Those later propositions, 94 and 96, are a part of the last section of the Principia, section 14. It's an optical section. It's a section about optics. As far as I know, there's no really good explanation for why that's even there, right? Except that Newton, the usual explanation, is Newton has now tools to consider what would be motion through an unimpeding medium, but a medium that is composed of particles that have gravitational attraction to one another. So he just runs through this and derives Snell's law and some other optical results. In the scholium to that section, he writes the following. Therefore, because of the analogy there is between the propagation of the rays of light and the motion of bodies, I thought it not amiss to add the following propositions for optical uses, not at all considering the nature of the rays of light or inquiring whether they are bodies or not, but only determining the curves of bodies, which are extremely like the curves of rays. Fair enough, right? But Newton has said exactly the same thing in the 1670s debate with Hooke. The debate with Hooke and some other people regarding Newton's theory of colors, which had caused Newton to withdraw from public philosophy for a large period of time. He said, I don't want to engage in public debates. I'm done with this. Newton wrote there, to examine how colors may be explained hypothetically is besides my purpose. I never intended to show wherein consists the nature and difference of colors, but only to show that they are de facto original and mutable qualities of the rays, which exhibit them, and to leave it to others to explicate by mechanical hypothesis the nature and difference of those qualities. That is, he marshals the same point. I'm not looking at the nature of light. I'm just investigating some properties, mathematical or otherwise, in fact. So there's no way that even in these late propositions, Newton writing this, he couldn't have thought of Hooke yet again. Right, because it's the very same debate he had with Hooke. And so it seems to make sense that Hooke is in fact, that Galileo is now brought up again in those propositions. Because what he attributes to Hooke, what in Newton's mind Hooke gave to him, was the right motions to compound in celestial motion. So once again, Galileo's name comes up. All right, one last thing. Newton claims that Galileo had discovered the two first laws of motion. That he discovered the parabola by means of the first two laws of motion. And that is to say that everything Galileo says is, in fact, in some measure, supporting my own theory. Now, we know that, in fact, as a matter of intellectual development, Descartes was very important for the genesis of Newton's laws. Right. So, question, right? Why does Newton never attribute
any influence to Descartes. The usual answer was, well, I just said all this. The usual answer is that Newton feels betrayed by Descartes' unworkable definition of relative motion, and we see in De Grave and his tussles with Cartesians in the 1670s, and he just becomes vigilant. And he just, you know, never wants to speak of Descartes ever again. Descartes just had the wrong project in mind. It's moronic, it's idiotic, the laws of motion are false, etc. He does mention Descartes, by the way, in that optical section I just mentioned as also responsible for the law of attraction. But I think this story gives us a slightly more concrete reason to not give credence to Descartes. That is, appealing to Descartes doesn't fulfill the functions that appealing to Galileo does. It doesn't evoke a class of motions that could be subsumed. And so Cartesian motion, whatever that is, provides no further evidence for Newton's procedures, for Newton's laws. That's just another way of saying that Cartesian motion just muddies the water about the relevant sorts of motions and forces to compound. Right? That is, Descartes just gives you these general laws that don't really pick out any motions in the world. Right? There are these abstract laws of collision. They don't suggest procedures, and they don't suggest classes of phenomena the way Galileo's laws do. So I think this is an additional reason, now a sort of an intellectually honest reason, not to mention Descartes in all these. I think I'm out of time. I had some sort of historiographical things to say, but let's just stop there.